Down below on the trail, Jasper Meeks didn't like the smell of things. Although he hadn't seen an Indian, he could almost feel their presence close by. After years of scouting for General Crook and Phil Sheridan, he had developed a sixth sense.
Mr. Clements, we's gonna have to move through that tight pass up yonder, and that sure as hell be the right spot for an Indian ambush.
But it's the only way through these terrible mountains.
Oh, there's other ways around, only it'll take a few extra days to swing so far north.
I say we drive through the pass. We have two women sick with fever, and we must get them to the closest doctor.
Well, fever won't matter much if they got shot dead moving through that tight spot, but it's up to you. You're doing the paying, and I'm only giving you my advice.
You really think Apaches would attack so many of us?
Yep, there's enough of them.
I say the risk is worth taking. We need to get the women to medical attention. Take us through the pass.
Jasper gave the peaks ahead a closer look. He could all but smell the presence of Indians close at hand.
Tell all your menfolk to get their rifles out and loaded, just in case.
Billy Clements swung his horse away to inform the other outriders of Jasper's warning. The first volley of gunfire from above sent Jasper diving off his horse to the ground with his rifle. He belly crawled to a spot behind a slab of limestone falling from the rim and kept his head down, waiting, listening. An oxen collapsed in its yoke with blood pumping from a hole in its side. Billy Clements was shot off his horse with a bullet through his neck. He landed hard. Jasper had tried to warn the settlers, but none would listen. They were defenseless. Jasper had only one thing on his mind, getting out alive. Jasper eyed his escape route, a way to move up the pass to fetch his horse and stay close behind the shelter of fallen boulders. Crawling, he moved from rock to rock, leaving the settlers to fend for themselves. He felt no remorse for leaving them behind. Jasper spotted his roan less than 100 yards up the pass where it had stopped, ears pricked forward.
If only that damn roan will stay still.
Help us, Mr. Meeks!
For a moment, Jasper felt a touch of shame, abandoning these helpless people like he was, but he aimed to get out of the pass alive.
Help us!
Jasper took a terrible risk. He came to a crouch with his rifle cradled in one arm and took off in an awkward run, staying as low as he could. A slug plowed up a spit of sand and dirt near his feet. He dove behind a rock and lay there collecting himself. He glanced back down the pass. Apache warriors were running between the wagons with bloody knives, slicing off every scalp they could find. Jasper jumped up again and took off in a zigzag run toward his gelding, praying that the Indians were distracted with their scalping. He made it to his roan just in the nick of time. He swung over his saddle and gathered his reins, drumming his heels into the gelding's sides. His horse was eager to escape the exploding guns and ran as hard as he could across rough ground. Jasper risked a glance over his shoulder. An Indian on a pinto pony was charging up the pass. The warrior had a rifle to his shoulder. Jasper Meeks knew a thing or two about shooting from atop a moving horse. He quickly brought his Winchester up, turning back in the saddle, aiming carefully. He took his time, steadying the muzzle of his rifle until he was certain of his target. The young Apache went flying off the back of the pinto, flinging his rifle away to grab a wound in his chest.
Gotcha.
His roan reached the end of the pass. Jasper found himself in open desert country. The red roan was a thoroughbred cross, and it had plenty of speed and stamina. He turned his horse north to head for Fort Thomas. No more Indians were following him, and after about a quarter of a mile of hard galloping, he slowed down to a short lope. Still watchful, he pushed toward Tombstone and Fort Thomas. One thing he was sure of, none of the settlers would make the journey. He celebrated silently that he had escaped a close call and not lost his scalp. Reaching into his saddlebags, he pulled out a bottle of red-eye whiskey. Naiche stood near the spring, watching Issa and the others ride into the mountain valley.
Chakotay waited beside him.
Look, Naiche. The horses are loaded with bundles of rifles.
Naiche noticed several of the braves with Issa were wearing bloody uniform coats around their shoulders.
Issa has won a great victory against the Bluecoats. We are much stronger now.
Nana is with them. He is wise and a brave fighter.
We must send word to Geronimo in Mexico. He will be pleased.
Now we can strike the white settlement south of the town called Tombstone.
Naiche said nothing as Issa galloped his horse away from the line of warriors, riding up to Naiche and giving the sign of friendship.
We have killed more than 40 of the Bluecoats, and we took rifles from the stinking fort along with many horses. See how many warriors have come to join you? I bring all this to you, Chief Naiche, so we may begin war.
It is good.
We took many scalps. We killed all the soldiers who followed us and have brought their supplies along with the horses. More warriors will slip away from the reservation when they hear of our great victory.
You are a brave warrior, Issa. You will tell the others of your victory at Council Fire. Tonight, the people will celebrate the courage of you and your warriors. But more soldiers will come. The war will be long, and many of the people will die. But the spirits are with us now, and we will drive the whites from our homeland forever.
All the warriors must be trained in the use of many-shoot rifles, how to load and fire them. Tonight at the council fire, we must begin their training.
There is little time before more soldiers are sent to follow your tracks, Issa. We must be ready to strike the settlement near Tombstone in 2 or 3 suns.
With these guns, our warriors will have the strength of 5 times their number. I will give each warrior a rifle and a box of bullets before we gather at the council fire.
Warriors sat on the ground, each holding a Winchester rifle, as Chakotay instructed them. Naiche watched with satisfaction.
The young men are ready for war, Naiche. I can see it on their faces. We have been like sheep on the reservation.
There will be much suffering and much bloodshed, Nana.
Will Geronimo join us?
He will fight his own fight. He is guided by a powerful spirit voice that tells him where to hit the enemy and when to hide.
But you are war chief of the Chiricahuas. He must follow you.
Naiche knew Geronimo would never follow him into battle unless his spirit voice is ordered.
Geronimo has no chief. He listens only to the spirits. He seeks vengeance, and he will do it in his own way.
Then we must strike the settlement near Tombstone quickly and return to these mountains. Soldiers will be looking for us everywhere, and soon.
We will leave with the rising sun. We will never return to the fort, Nana. Some of us will die so the others may remain free Apaches.
My spirit is happy now. If I must die to keep our people free, I am ready.
At night, lantern light made golden squares of the windows across a settlement known to the white man as Bisbee. It was a collection of adobe mud huts and corrals filled with domestic farm stock. Naiche and 20 warriors moved silently toward Bisbee in the dark of a moonless night, spreading out, forming a circle from which no one could escape. The other Apaches came toward Bisbee, leaning low over their horses' necks, rifles ready. Chakotay led 5 young warriors charging into the village. Suddenly awake, some settlers fired shots at fast-moving shadows darting among the houses. Naiche rode toward a white man firing a shotgun at the raiders and pulled the trigger on his Winchester. The farmer with the shotgun was lifted off his feet and sent tumbling to the ground. Naiche's horse carried him swiftly toward another target, a man firing 2 pistols at the Apache intruders. Naiche was rewarded with another victory when the white man collapsed in front of his adobe holding a wound in his belly. Thirsting for white man's blood, Naiche jerked his horse to a sliding halt and jumped down with his knife drawn. He raced to the farmer who had been firing his shotgun. Naiche brandished the steaming bloody trophy high overhead.
Kill them all! Leave none alive!
Toza came running up to Naiche, his Winchester in one hand, a pair of bloody scalps in the other.
It is the magic of the rifles, Naiche. See how easily the white eyes die when we have their guns.
The power of the spirits is with us now.
Naiche swung over his horse's withers
filled with satisfaction. Before they left the settlement, they would leave their mark on every corpse, taking every scalp before they looted the houses for food and weapons. When they were finished, they would drive off the livestock. The cattle and goats could be hidden in high mountain canyons. Their meat would make plentiful food, and their skins could be made into blankets and coats.
They are all dead, Naiche, and not a one of us has suffered an injury. It is a sign that this will be a good war. We will defeat the white soldiers and drive them back east.
Open the gates of all the corrals and drive the cattle and goats and mules to the south. We must be careful to hide our tracks, for the soldiers will hear of this, and they will come after us.
Let them come. They will all be killed.
It was just after dawn, and Falcon and his men were breaking camp while a light snow was falling. Hawk rummaged in his saddlebags as he prepared to mount his horse.
Hey, Falcon, I'm getting a mite low on provisions. How about you?
Me too. Now that there are three of us to feed, it might be wise to see about stocking up before we head farther into the mountains. Is there any place nearby where we could pick up supplies?
Well, there's Bisbee's Corners. It ain't much, just a few settlers, but there's a store there, and my partners and I used to go to it. I figure it's about 6, maybe 7 miles west of here.
Hawk, it wouldn't hurt to make a run over there and get some more food and cartridges. If we're gonna make war on the Apache, we're gonna need all the ammunition we can carry.
Could be they might have some news from somebody whereabouts Apache were last seen, too.
Cal, why don't you lead the way to Bisbee? I wouldn't mind a hot bath if they have one.
Well, don't get your hopes up. It ain't all that big a place, and from what I've seen of the settlers there, don't none of them appear to have much of a craving for bathing.
After the three men had been traveling for about an hour, Cal held up his hand and reined his horse to a stop.
What's going on, Cal? Why'd you stop?
You hear that? Sounds like a bunch of riders coming this way.
Get off the trail, quick!
Hawk and Cal followed Falcon, just barely managing to get out of sight before a band of Apache braves came galloping over the ridge. They were driving a few head of cattle and horses in front, and all were carrying Winchester rifles. Cal jacked a shell into the chamber of his rifle, his face a mask of hate when he saw the bloody scalps hanging from the manes of the ponies. Falcon reached over and put his hand on the rifle, shaking his head.
They got us outnumbered 8-1, Cal. We wouldn't stand a fighting chance now.
But they'll get away.
No, they won't. It'll be easy enough to trail if they keep those cattle.
After the Indians rode out of sight, driving the beeves ahead of them, Falcon and the others came out of hiding. Falcon could see Cal's hand shaking, his knuckles white as he gripped his rifle.
Cal, the only way we've got a chance is to pick our fights. We have to hit and run, picking them off a few at a time. There are too many for us to go up against and hope to come out on top.
Yeah, I know. It's just when I saw them all covered with blood, I couldn't think of nothing except what they'd done to Billy and Johnny and Frank.
It looks like they were coming from the direction of Bisbee. You don't think they had the nerve to attack an entire town, do you?
Apaches have never been accused of not having nerve. We better take a look.
Yeah, there might be somebody left alive and needs our help.
Falcon gave Hawk a look. Both knew if the Apaches had indeed hit Bisbee, there'd be no survivors. As they rode through what was left of the small settlement, Falcon could feel his stomach turn. He turned his head and saw a figure riding slowly down the street. The man had long, flowing silver hair and was wearing buckskins. His Winchester was cradled in his arms, the barrel pointing toward the trio.
Looks like we're not alone.
Hawk twisted in his saddle, his hand automatically moving toward his pistol.
Now hold on, Hawk. He's just riding in like us. He didn't have anything to do with this.
The man walked his gelding up to him, his eyes narrow and suspicious.
Howdy, gents.
Howdy. My name's Falcon McAllister, and this here's Hawk Hawkins, Cal Franklin.
I'm Jasper Meeks. Looks like the Apache got here ahead of me. 2 days ago, I was leading a wagon train across the desert, and we was hit by a bunch of Apache. They had repeating rifles. We didn't stand a chance.
He pulled an almost empty bottle of whiskey out of his saddlebags and took a deep drink.
You say you was leading this group? How is it you managed to escape and the others didn't?
Just what do you mean by that, mister? The first volley spooked my horse and I was thrown to the ground.
By the time I was able to chase them down, it was all just about over, so I climbed on and rode like the devil himself was after me.
You mean you left the others to be killed?
It wouldn't have made no difference. Like I said, they had us outnumbered 3-1, and they had repeating rifles.
How come it took you so long to get here?
After that, I didn't dare ride on the trail. I went into the brush and heavy forest and kept to the backside of the mountains, where there wasn't no chance of another ambush.
And a hell of a lot safer than staying and fighting beside your friends.
Listen, Hawk, or whatever your name is. I tried to warn those crazy pilgrims not to go through that pass, but they wouldn't listen to me. I tried to warn them.
You don't have to explain anything to us, Mr. Meeks. It's not up to us to judge you. We weren't there. Now, let's separate and comb the town. There might be someone they missed, hiding somewhere, waiting for help to arrive.
2 hours later, the men met back in the center of town. They'd found not a living soul. Falcon got off Diablo and walked into the general store. The shelves and cabinets were destroyed. Foodstuffs were scattered across the floor, but many were still in good enough shape to eat.
They must have been in a hurry. They didn't ruin what they didn't take with them. Let's gather up what we can salvage and get on our way. The army's going to be coming this way, and I don't particularly want to have to explain what we're doing out here.
Why not?
Because they'll order us back to Tombstone. And to avoid a damn stupid fight with the army, we'll have to oblige them.
They loaded up as much food and extra ammunition as they could carry.
What are you gents going to do now?
We passed the band of Indians that did this on the trail. They were driving some cattle and livestock they rustled from the town. I figure they'll spread out, leaving a few braves to drive the cattle, while the rest hurry back to their main camp with the rifles they stole. I don't plan on letting them get those cattle to the camp. How about you?
I was planning on heading on into Tombstone, but it's all the same to you, man. I think I'd kind of like to come with you.
You sure? It ain't exactly the safest thing to do.
I'm sure.
That's good enough for me.
It took them until just before dark to catch up to the Indians driving the cattle and to ride around their flanks and get ahead of them on the trail. Falcon positioned Hawk and Cal and Meeks on ridges on either side of the road while he prepared himself for a frontal assault. He loaded both barrels of his express shotgun with double-aught buckshot and stuck an extra Colt in his belt where he could grab it with either hand. He walked Diablo to a spot in the middle of the path and waited. As the Indians rounded the curve in the road, they pulled on their rope halters and halted their ponies. They talked among themselves for a moment. They couldn't understand why the white man didn't turn tail and run. Suddenly, Falcon leaned forward and spurred his horse into a gallop toward him. Hawk fired from the left side of the road. The lead brave was blown off his horse, his chest blossomed in blood as he fell beneath the hooves of his friends. Cows and Meeks' Winchesters knocked another red man off his mount and doubled another over his pony's neck. As the others rode down on Falcon, he stretched his arm out and fired the shotgun. The closest of the attack saved Falcon's life. The Indians didn't have time to aim their rifles and fired from the hip. One of the remaining Indians jerked his pony to a halt, aimed and fired his rifle at Falcon, cutting a groove in the meat of his thigh but missing the bone. The brave jacked another shell into his rifle and kicked his mount into a dead run right at Falcon, firing again from the hip but missing. Falcon answered with his left-hand Colt. A bullet hit the Indian square in the forehead, throwing him from the horse which ran off the trail. The last two braves reined to a halt, uncertain what to do. As they sat there, watching Falcon, two shots from the forest rang out. The Sharps and the Winchesters knocked them from their saddles to the frozen ground below. Falcon walked Diablo around the battle scene, looking at the crimson splotches dotting the sparse patches of melting snow. When they rode up, Cal was grinning from ear to ear.
God damn! I ain't never seen nothing like that, Falcon. You just charged right into the thick of them.
It wasn't as brave as it seems, Cal. The only way to fight the Apaches is to surprise them. I had to do something they didn't expect. That's why those rifles didn't do them any good. You need a pistol or shotgun for close-in fighting.
Still, you got to have cojones as big as melons to do that.
Come on, Hawk, Meeks. We've got work to do. We're gonna send a message to the men that ride with Naiche. Indians have some funny notions about not being able to see or find their way to their heaven if their eyes are missing. When Neche sends a scout back to see why the cattle didn't arrive, we want him to see this and carry the word back to his chief that some crazy killers are on his trail. He'll know from what we do to the bodies that we're not army, and he'll wonder just who the hell is after him.
Hey, Cap! Why don't you round up those ponies, take the rope holders off, and use them to string these bodies up in some nearby trees? Wouldn't want coyotes to get at them before Naiche scout sees them.
I'll do it, but that don't mean I approve of what you're doing.
This is war, plain and simple. When we took out after Naiche and his band of killers, we set out on a course that has only one possible ending. Their death or ours. So I'm gonna do anything that might give us an edge. They might make Naiche look over his shoulder. They might make his warriors a little fearful or hesitant. I want them all to know what's going to happen to them if they lose. And I want them to think about that when they see us coming.
Don't none of us like it, partner. It's just something we got to do. Now let's get to it.
Colonel Thomas Grant surveyed the grisly scene from the back of his horse. Buzzards circled high above the sun-bloated corpses of Major Wilson Tarver's command. Dead troopers were lying all along the bottom of a ravine.
Captain Jones, it's the worst damn thing I ever seen. Hell, it wasn't enough to kill them, but the way they mutilated them. It's senseless.
It's that damn Naiche and the bunch that run off with him. Do you want me to form a burial detail, sir?
It seems a shame to bury them way out here without proper grave markers or any type of ceremony.
The only thing we can do is ride back to the fort and send back wagons so we can bury them at the fort.
That sounds more humane, Captain. Send a messenger to Fort Thomas with orders to bring back 3 wagons and a squad of men.
Well, we found Major Tarver, sir, like the others. He was scalped and his belly was cut open. Found him over near that big rock.
I'll send for the wagons.
Sergeant? See if those half-drunk Pawnees have picked up any of the Apache tracks.
Grant felt helpless, and he let his shoulders droop. Finding Apaches out in these wilds was next to impossible. They knew how to disappear without leaving a trace. Grant knew his report to his superiors regarding this affair would look bad on his record. The men and their safety was his responsibility. A young cavalryman trotted his horse up to the colonel and saluted.
They took most of their boots and shirts, sir. Every pistol and rifle is gone, too, along with the ammunition. The buzzards have been eating on them for a couple of days. I was wondering what you wanted us to do with the bodies.
Bring down the bodies that are up on the side of the canyon. I've sent for wagons. Place all the bodies in a row so they can be loaded up. I fully understand it won't be a pleasant chore, but it must be done out of respect for our fellow soldiers.
Yes, sir.
Captain Jones returned from dispatching the messenger.
We'll make those red bastards pay for what they did here.
We gotta find them first, Colonel. That ain't gonna be no easy job. This is their home range. They'll know every hiding place there is to be had.
We need to find competent scouts, Captain. Those Pawnees are useless. If we could find one man who knew what he was doing, he could track those savages down.
Somebody told me there was this fella who rode into Tombstone right about the time they had that shootout at the OK Corral. He's supposed to be some sort of expert on hunting and killing Indians. When we get back to the fort, I'll ask old man Sutterth. He was the one who told me about him.
One good tracker can save us valuable time. If we can locate him, I'll make him an offer.
As the bodies were being organized, a soldier came riding at a gallop toward Colonel Grant's temporary campsite. He saw the colonel and rode over to him, jerking his winded mount to a halt.
More bad news, Colonel. The entire population of Bisbee's Corner has been wiped out, slaughtered by Indians. Every last one of them, sir.
Did you see this for yourself?
No, sir. But an old prospector who hangs around the sutler's store came upon it, and he headed straight for the fort.
How many lives were lost?
34 in Bisbee, sir, including the women and kids. And...
Out with it, man.
On the way to the fort, the prospector came across another massacre. A wagon train filled with settlers was also hit. There were no survivors there, either.
Naiche has gone on a killing spree. Now that he and his bucks have Winchester rifles and fresh horses.
Dear God, there's no telling where this will end unless we find Naiche quickly. He could go on raiding for months.
Grant's mind raced,
thinking of what this would look like when his superiors heard about the Bisbee massacre. He envisioned himself being relieved of his command.
What shall I tell Major Evans, sir?
Grant had left Major Carl Evans in command of the fort while he rode out to look for Major Tarver's missing troops.
Tell him I'll be back tomorrow and to prepare every able-bodied man and horse for a major campaign against the runaway Apaches. Take a fresh horse and return to the fort immediately.
Yes, sir.
There's another thing to think about, Colonel, and it could be the worst news yet. Now that he's got maybe 20 or 30 fighting men and twice that many rifles, Naiche might join up with Geronimo.
Geronimo seems to have disappeared since he left the San Carlos Reservation. No one has heard of him or seen him since.
Word is, Geronimo is down in Mexico, raiding rancheros for horses and attacking small Federale patrols to get their rifles and ammunition. Old man Sutter heard tell that Geronimo is hiding out in his Sierra Madres, building himself an army. Apaches are hard to kill or capture because they break up into small groups after a raid. Our scouts never know which tracks to follow, and when they do find several sets of tracks, the Indians split up again into twos and threes.
Leave now for the fort and find out who this newcomer is. Make that your top priority, Captain. I'll be back at the fort by noon tomorrow, unless we run into difficulties. I plan to ride over to Bisbee's Corner on my return trip, and tell Major Evans to send a burial detail to Bisbee.
Jones rode away at a hard gallop. Colonel Grant felt a chill run down his spine. War was in the making, and he would be caught squarely in the middle of it. Naiche watched as they prepared the body of Yapo for burial in the cave high on a mountain overlooking the valley. The white man with silver hair had killed the boy with a single shot from the back of a running horse. There would be many more burial ceremonies before the war against the whites was over.
Toza has not returned. The soldiers may have captured him or killed him.
I sent Issa and three more to look for him, Chicole. Toza knows the ways of the mountains and deserts. He may be watching the fort to see how many soldiers are sent to look for us.
The soldier horses with iron shoes leave tracks that are easy to follow.
We cross the rocks wherever we can. Only a man who knows how to read sign like an Indian will notice the tiny scars on the rocks. We will move south soon, deeper into the mountains, to the steep canyon the old ones called Deer Springs. There is grass for the horses, goats, and cattle, and the trail is very long and narrow, easy to defend if the Bluecoats follow us.
I remember the deep canyon. It seems so long since we made camp there.
A brave must be sent back to the reservation to tell others where we are so they will join us. Word has to be taken to San Carlos, so Mimbres and other Apaches will know we are preparing for a great war and where to find us.
I will go. The Bluecoats will be less suspicious of a woman. I will wear an old deerskin dress and no one will notice me.
Then go with tomorrow's sun. Ride one of the starving ponies and carry only a knife hidden under your dress. It will be dangerous, but word must reach the others that we have guns and food and horses.
Naiche vowed to make the old white man with silver hair pay for killing Yapo if he ever saw the wagon scout again. Naiche heard the signal that indicated someone was approaching the camp. He walked to the cave entrance. Issa, along with the braves who had been sent with him, were leading ponies with bodies folded across their backs. Naiche walked rapidly down to meet the procession.
Is it Toza you have found?
We found no trace. These are our brothers who were left behind after the attack on the White Eyes village to drive the cattle and mules to our camp.
Issa pulled the blankets off the corpses. Naiche felt as if someone had punched him in the stomach. He stared at the mutilated bodies, their skulls glistening in the moonlight where their scalps had been ripped off. Their empty eye sockets stared straight through him.
The White Eyes could not do this. It must be the Kiowa, brother to the Comanche, our ancestral enemies from the dawn of time.
But the Kiowa are all on reservations.
So were we less than a moon ago, Chicole.
It is true that they do mark their victims as we do, but why would they suddenly make war on us?
If they have escaped the reservation, then it may be no more than hunger for our cattle, Issa. Warn the others. Be watchful for any sign of the Kiowa.
Toza returned an hour later. Naiche waited for Toza in front of his wickiup.
Many Bluecoats came to the arroyo where Issa killed the soldiers. They had two pony scouts with them.
Did they find Issa's tracks?
No. The Pawnees were drinking, and they only rode a short distance and went to sleep under a tree.
Where are the soldiers now?
The soldiers waited until big wagons came. Then they loaded the bodies of their dead and drove away. But a rider had come, and some of the soldiers rode off to the white settlement, where we killed so many. More soldiers rode out to look for our tracks, but they behaved strangely, riding in big circles, climbing off their horses to talk and point to the ground. They followed our trail until they came to the place where we crossed the flat rocks. They stopped and went back to the village to bury the dead. More will come to look for us. I saw their dust to the north just before the sun went down.
Then it is time to move our camp deeper into the mountains. You have done well, Toza.
Naiche thought about the dust cloud Toza had seen, wondering how many soldiers had been sent to look for him, and if they had a scout who knew how to read signs. He also wondered if the cloud of dust could be from Kiowas. More than anything else, Naiche needed more warriors to use the repeating rifles. It was useless to have so many guns when there was no one to fire them, especially if there were to be two different enemies to fight. Chakole, dressed in a torn, badly stained deerskin dress, rode a slope-shouldered gray Indian pony into the rows of army barracks where Apaches were forced to live. A pair of guards hardly noticed her. Apache women on the reservation were allowed to go down to the river to wash clothes and bathe themselves. Some soldiers watched the younger Apache's girl where they were naked in the river. Chakole tied the pony behind one of the buildings and traveled from room to room, speaking in a whisper, telling all who would listen about Naiche's plan, the rifles and the horses and food, and of their victories. Some of the younger Apache men listened eagerly, while others waved Chakole away, broken in spirit. But as she continued, more and more warriors paid attention.
Leave at night, only a few at a time. Do not steal horses or guns. Run as fast as you can to the foothills of the Dragoons. We will be waiting for you with horses and rifles and food. Leave no tracks. Run across the rocky ground and stay far from the village of Tombstone. The foothills are not far, and we will be waiting for you.
Chakole spoke with Chiricahuas, Membris, Mescaleros, and Warm Springs Apaches. In the hours before dawn, she mounted a gray pony and rode quietly past two sleeping guards at the fort gates. Almost 30 Apaches had promised to slip away from the reservation over the next 2 days to join Naiche. All things considered, it was an excellent start. Captain Buford Jones pushed the bad wings open and swaggered into Campbell and Hatch's saloon. Though it was the middle of the day, the popular eating place was already full of cowboys and businessmen of Tombstone. Jones had two privates with him, both as escorts and bodyguards, since the army wasn't all that popular with the miners and cattlemen around the area.
Attention, people of Tombstone! I'm looking for a man named McAllister, Falcon McAllister. He was here in Tombstone last week, and the army is willing to pay for any information that'll help me find him.
For a moment, no one moved. Then everyone turned back to their drinks and food, all except two men. They continued to stare at Jones as they whispered among themselves. Finally, they got up from their seats and approached him.
This Falcon you're looking for, he a big man riding a big black stud horse?
The two men were miners, in town to hole up until the worst of the winter passed.
Do you know anything about his whereabouts?
Yeah, first, what about the money you promised for information?
Jones produced his wallet.
$20 if what you tell me leads to Falcon.
Jake and me was bringing in some wagons with the bodies of a family killed by Injuns. And this here Falcon feller stopped us on the edge of town.
Bodies?
Yep. There was 5 or 6 men and women lived in a cabin up in the Dragoons kilt a couple of weeks ago. All cut up and butchered they was. Falcon got real upset when he took a gander at the bodies. Asked where the cabin was and then said something under his breath about not letting the Injuns get away with any more killings. Then he hightailed it toward the road leading into the Dragoons. I figured it must be crazy to go up into those mountains with the Injuns on a warpath again. Where's our money?
Private Gutman will take down your names and addresses. If we find Falcon, the money will be sent to you.
We don't exactly have an address. We mine up in the Dragoons most of the year, but you can leave the money with the bartender here. We'll check back every now and then.
Jones turned to the bar when a man stepped up next to him. The man's skin was pale, covered with a fine sheen of sweat.
Hello, Captain.
Good afternoon, sir.
Just what is it you want with Falcon McAllister?
That's the Army's business, not yours, mister.
Quick as a flash, the man's hand moved, and a pistol barrel was stuck on the left side of Jones's abdomen.
Captain, do you happen to know anything of anatomy?
No, sir.
My Colt is nudged up against your liver and your gallbladder. Now, if I let the hammer down, the bullet will pass right through those organs. If you're lucky, a major artery will be hit and you'll die within minutes. However, if Lady Luck happens to be looking somewhere else, you will live for days to weeks, sweating, puking, generally being in the most excruciating pain. Do I make myself perfectly clear?
Who are you?
My name's John Henry Holliday, but most folks just call me Doc.
What is it you want?
I'm just asking a perfectly civil question. What does the Army want with Falcon?
I was asked to try to find him to see if he would do some scouting for us. Word is that Falcon McAllister is an accomplished tracker who knows the ways of the Apache.
The pressure against Jones's stomach disappeared, and Holliday turned to go.
There now, that wasn't so bad, was it? Now, Mr. Army Captain, Falcon is a friend of mine. If I find out the Army causes him any harm or harassment, there won't be a rock large enough for you to hide under. Good day, sir.
Ishtan, Kuchiyo, Teo, and Jug scouted the foothills for any sign of soldier patrols approaching the Dragoons from the east. They had also been instructed by Naiche to keep a sharp lookout for any sign of Kiowa and to report back if any were sighted. They rode strong cavalry horses and carried Winchester rifles and Colt pistols. Naiche wanted to be prepared against a surprise attack. He had moved the village to the canyon called Deer Springs, where their stronghold would be easier to defend. From Deer Springs, they would launch raids before returning to their isolated camp in some of the most rugged terrain high in the mountain range. Kuchiyo suddenly halted his horse as they were on the edge of a thicket of scrub pinyon pines. The other stopped on either side of him.
What is it, Kuchiyo?
4 white men, not soldiers. One rides a big black horse, and he wears buckskins. One is old. I could see his white hair. He has a gray hat covering his face. Another with silver hair. He sits straight and does not seem old. One rides slowly at the rear, slumped over his saddle. They are cautious. The tall man looked up at this mountain and quickly led the other white eyes into a dry stream bed, as if he saw us. They are staying out of sight.
No white man could see us hidden in these trees.
This tall one is different, Ishtan. He looked up here and turned his horse to ride out of sight too quickly. He saw something, and he is taking no chances. He may be a scout for the soldiers. He knows our ways. His leggings are like those of the Utes or the Arapaho. The two with white hair also wear deer skins. These whites are not soldiers or farmers.
What should we do?
Kuchiyo gave the dry stream bed's wandering course a close examination. There were few places where they could ambush men who were careful, watchful, and expected trouble. But farther up the stream bed, where it came down out of the steeper hills from the high peaks, clusters of trees and rocks might offer the perfect spot.
One of us must ride back to the village and warn Naiche of these 4 white eyes coming into our mountains. Ja, you ride back to the canyon. Ishtan and Teo and I will watch these whites. And if they start along any of the trails, we will find the right spot to kill them.
P. Cuchillo studied the stream bed. He was still sure the tall white man had seen him.
I see nothing.
This is what troubles me. Very few white men know how to disappear like an Apache.
Teo pointed to a group of sparrows suddenly leaving the limbs of a mesquite thicket on the banks of the stream bed, flying west as if something had startled them.
There, Chichio. The birds tell us where they are now. If the white eyes continue along the stream, they will come to the deer trail leading to Deer Springs Canyon.
Cuchillo watched the flight of the birds. They flew a few hundred yards westward and then settled into the brush.
Yes, the birds announce their movements. They ride slowly, for look, the sparrows do not go far. If the birds fly again, we will know these whites are climbing into the mountains looking for us, as scouts for the bluecoats. Wait for the sparrows. If they rise again, we will ride higher and find a place in the rocks where killing them will be easy. Remember your training as warriors. Patience and surprise will give us the advantage. Yes, they are looking for us. Ride slowly so we send no dust into the air. We will find a killing place where the stream bed comes down from the edge of the mountains.
Cuchillo wheeled his horse and led Ishtan and Teo off the back of the hilltop. They would ride many extra miles to stay out of the sight of these white men until they found the right spot to lay in wait for a deadly ambush. Soon, Teo lay behind a slab of stone, hidden in its shadow so the sun would not reflect off the barrel of his Winchester. Ishtan rested on his belly behind fans of yucca spines on a ledge above the creek bed, where he had a view of the rocky bottom of the wash, his rifle barrel covered with a soldier's shirt. Cuchillo hid behind a crevice between two jutting outcrops of stone on the other side of the wash, giving him a clear view of the path below. The flight of more startled birds pointed to the progress of the white eyes as they were climbing into the eastern edge of the mountain range. Cuchillo took note of the slow progress. It meant they stopped often. These were the actions of cautious, experienced men. The whites were careful never to show themselves, staying in deeper shadows as the sun lowered. It was further proof that they intended to enter the dragoons unseen. Time passed slowly, and now no more birds darted from the brush.
They have stopped. Are they resting their horses? There's no water in the wash for their horses, a little shade. Are they waiting for darkness to continue?
The voice came from the yuccas where Ishtan was hiding.
Something's wrong.
Very slowly, Cuchillo raised his rifle to his shoulder. Then he saw movement in the yucca plant. Something was tossed from Ishtan's hiding place. Ishtan's severed head lay in a spreading puddle of blood on the gravel at the bottom of the creek. One of the white men had been silent enough to slip up behind Ishtan. They were stalking Cuchillo and his warriors. He glanced over his shoulder, carefully checking every rock and clump of brush behind him. He saw nothing and quickly turned his attention back to the stream. No sign of movement. The cry came from the rock where Teo waited in ambush. Teo's coppery body was pushed off the top of the cut bank, a crimson stain smearing the rocky slide of the wash as he slid down to the floor of the stream. A huge gash across his throat spilled blood across the dry bank. Now Cuchillo faced the four white men alone. Naiche had been told about these white-skinned warriors. Very slowly, Cuchillo backed away from the crevice and bent down in a crouch, moving on the balls of his feet. He moved from one clump of brush to another. He came to the draw where their horses were tethered and swung up on his bay, gathering up the other horse's jaw reins before he drummed his heels into the gelding sides. Hawk eared back the hammer of his Sharps 50 caliber rifle and drew a bead on his back.
Hold on, Hawk. Let him go.
Why, Falcon? The bastard's sure to go back to the main camp and warn the others we're on our way.
I want Naiche and the others to know someone's on their trail. Someone who can kill just as good as they can. Maybe it'll distract him from thoughts of killing whites long enough for the army to get on his trail.
Cal Franklin and Jasper Meeks walked their horses up out of the old riverbed.
Why'd you fellas let him get away?
Falcon's got it in his mind to give Naiche something to worry about.
I'm following him.
With any luck, he'll lead us to Naiche's camp. You follow along, and I'll mark a trail as I go.
Well, you keep a tight rein on your scalp, you hear? Falcon followed Cuchillo at a safe distance, being careful not to reveal himself against the skyline on the horizon. He knew Apaches were expert trackers, but were less adept at discovering if someone was following them, the experience being so rare. As he rode, he occasionally leaned over to break a twig next to the trail or to blaze a mark on the trunk of a tree so the others would have no difficulty in following. Just before dusk, when the temperature was falling toward freezing, Falcon saw Cuchillo stop his pony and put his hands to his mouth.
Must be a signal that a friend is on the way in.
Falcon dismounted and tied Diablo to a tree, leaving him plenty of slack so he could graze on the mountain grass growing next to the trail. He unhooked the rawhide hammer thongs on his pistols and positioned his Winchester rifle across his back on its rawhide sling. He knew if he had to use either, he was as good as dead, for the sound of a gunshot would bring the Indians and Naiche's band like a swarm of hornets. He drew his Arkansas toothpick, hoping to find the sentry before he was seen. As shadows melded with darkening air and night fell, Falcon began to crawl toward the owl hoot answer to Cuchillo's call. He made sure not to put his feet on anything that would make a noise. He could smell the pungent aroma of unwashed Indian nearby. Grateful the Apache didn't much believe in baths, he put the blade of his knife between his teeth and crawled on all fours. Peeking between the branches of a mesquite tree, Falcon saw the sentry 10 feet ahead, his back against a boulder, arms folded, his head nodding on his chest as if he was tired from a long watch. Falcon elected to wait for the sentry's replacement so he would have more time after killing him to look around. Not more than 10 minutes later, the sentry jerked awake, his hand on his rifle. A young man walked up and slapped him on the shoulder. The newcomer took his place with his back to the same boulder, and the first sentry walked toward the valley. Falcon searched the ground at his feet with his hands in the darkness. After a moment, he found a small rock. He raised his hand and pitched the stone over the brave's head, where it landed in a briar patch a few yards from the man. The Indian jerked, his head whipping to the side and his rifle coming up as he turned toward the sound. Falcon made his move. Falcon felt his body stiffen as he placed his hand over the Indian's mouth and bent his head back, exposing his neck to the blade of the Arkansas tooth. Seconds later, Falcon lowered his dead body to the ground. He picked up the Winchester rifle, took the deerskin pouch of ammunition the man was carrying, and crept to the ridge overlooking the valley below.
Naiche picked his campsite well.
The valley was deep enough for several fires to be burning and not be seen from above. There was a small stream running through the valley floor. As he glanced around the ridge walls overlooking the campsite, Falcon saw many dark openings in the stone cliffs, some with small fires burning in them. Even though conventional wisdom would say it was foolish to camp in a valley, the presence of sentries could protect against unwanted visitors, and the number and placement of the caves would provide enough hiding places that it would take an army to ferret them out. Falcon knew he was dealing with someone skilled in warfare. Pulling his binoculars from his belt, Falcon surveyed the campsite below. He soon found the largest wickiup and the brave he'd been following talking with a man who could only be Naiche. Suddenly, Naiche reached out and grabbed the brave in front of him by the throat.
Damned if he ain't pissed off about that brave leaving his friends behind to die.
Finally, Naiche pushed the man away and turned his back on him, summoning others to gather around him. As he spoke to the group of young braves, he began pointing out certain men and pointing off in different directions.
Looks like he's going to send out war parties. Probably going to be coming after us. I better hightail it back up the trail and make sure the others get to a good hiding place. Maybe we'll just set up a little surprise for him.
Issa, Nana, Juh, and 7 more experienced warriors scattered throughout a pinyon pine forest along a trail climbing into the western edge of the Dragoons. It was the same trail where the braves had been killed.
Several of the warriors cast angry eyes at the tree where the bodies had been found hanging. After Naiche had heard the report from Kuchiyo, he sent over a dozen warriors to the east, led by Kuchiyo, to halt the four whites. He warned Kuchiyo not to return to camp without the scouts of the killers. Issa led a band of nine warriors to guard the western approaches to higher elevations. Naiche himself led six seasoned fighters to the north to keep an eye on soldier movements coming from Fort Thomas. Chakole rode with him, leaving Delshi, Naiche's half-brother, in charge of protecting the camp with 17 of the youngest Apaches. It was from the west where the chief believed the greatest danger would come, despite what Kuchiyo told him about the stealth of the white man. Naiche was correct to assume the soldiers would come first from the west. Riding in a column of paired cavalrymen, 32 heavily armed troopers climbed the steep game trail. Issa had spotted the soldiers easily from a lookout spot. He prepared his ambush where a pinyon forest would hide his warriors until the bluecoats were caught in a deadly crossfire. Picking just the right spot had taken considerable time. Nana saw that an Indian rode out in front of the cavalry, his face to the ground.
The scout who leads them is one of our own people, the old Mescalero named Yase. He betrays his own blood brothers for bottles of crazy water and extra rations of food. I have seen him at the fort. He tells the Bluecoat chief about Apaches who talk of escaping from the reservation, giving him their names so they will be put in the iron cages and given only moldy bread and water. He will be the first to die.
Issa felt sure of their success. With 10 repeating rifles being fired from fortified positions, the Bluecoats would have no escape, despite their numbers.
We must wait until they are between us. Let the first riders pass. The old one, Yase, will not see us. He only looks at the tracks.
Joe was on the far side of the trail with four more Apache riflemen spread out. Issa could see the faces of the troopers riding at the front of the column. He readied his rifle against his shoulder.